This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I don't know what to say. Seriously, I don't. Oil closed up almost 11 bucks today. The unemployment rate took its biggest jump in more than 20 years. Wall Street, forget about it. We'll tie it all together for you because from American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity. Online at us.areva.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday today, the 6th of June. Good to have you here. The American economy sort of had its own D-Day today. Forget for a little while the fact that the Dow lost 400 points. We'll get to that later on in the broadcast. What we all woke up thinking was going to be the story of the day today, unemployment, got short-circuited by oil. Crude topped $139 a barrel at its high today, closed up $10.75. A couple of things happened to bring that about. An analyst at Morgan Stanley decided to make some news, came out and said oil's going to hit $150 a barrel by the 4th of July. That got speculators going. And the head of the European Central Bank started talking about raising interest rates on the other side of the Atlantic. Marketplace's John Dimsdale makes it all make sense.
As oil prices marked their largest two-day increase in history, John Kingston was left scratching his head. He tracks oil for the energy information company Platts.
You don't move up $14 a barrel just on fundamentals when fundamentals haven't changed in 48 hours. But clearly there's been such a walloping of the dollar today. That is what's driving this over the last few days. Because there really is nothing else in the market right now that would indicate that there's a reason why oil should resume its growth.
The Federal Reserve Board's recent effort to talk up the value of the dollar was drowned out yesterday when the president of the European Central Bank dropped a big hint that he'll raise interest rates to fight inflation. Fed watcher David Jones.
That, of course, caused the dollar to fall, the euro to increase, and once again, the traders, in a knee-jerk way, sold or shorted the dollar and bought crude oil.
The traditional way to boost the dollar's value is to have the Fed raise interest rates. But the weaker dollar is helping U.S. exports. Besides, most of the Fed board members oppose higher rates, says Bank of America economist Mickey Levy.
The housing's still subtracting a lot. Financial markets are, of course, fragile, and the economy has slumped, and the unemployment rate is rising. Historically, these are not conditions where the Fed raises rates.
All of which points to continued higher oil prices. Goldman Sachs, Wall Street's most active investor in energy markets, predicts $200 per barrel oil within 2 years. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The oil story took its time getting going today, a slow drip, 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 if you will. But Wall Streeters were sweating early all the same thanks to the May unemployment report. 49,000 jobs lost and a big jump in the unemployment rate, up 0.5% to 5.5%. That's its biggest increase since 1986. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
There are two government surveys on employment. The payroll survey asks businesses how many people they're employing. The household survey checks in with individual households about who is employed and unemployed. Brian Bethune is chief U.S. financial economist with Global Insight. He says the payroll numbers have been dropping for several months.
Whereas the household numbers haven't been quite as weak as that. So we were expecting a shoot a drop on the household survey, and indeed that's what we got today.
It landed with a bigger thud than many expected. Diane Swonk is chief economist at Mesirow Financial. She's keeping her cool.
We probably overstated the increase, so not only did we have catch-up, we also have a hard time capturing when college students leave their campuses and enter the labor force for summer jobs.
So she says we could see a dip in unemployment in June, but in general, employment is on a downward slide, says Global Insight's Brian Bethune.
If you look at the sectors that have been shedding jobs, construction, automotive, and financial services, we don't see that trend changing for another 3 or 4 months.
Employers have been cutting workers' hours too, but they've boosted productivity. So Swonk says today's sell-off on Wall Street is short-sighted.
Over the course of the next 12 months or so, we're going to see profits actually recover fairly nicely, and I think that's going to ultimately be reflected in equity prices.
But she says it'll take a lot longer before Main Street bounces back. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Barack Obama has a job, but as we all know, he's looking to move up the ladder a little bit. And he is shaking up the establishment now that he's got the Democratic nomination wrapped up. Obama's putting his people in key jobs, and he's going to make the party live by his campaign's rule on taking money from lobbyists and political action committees.
I am announcing that going forward, the Democratic National Committee will uphold the same standard. We will not take a dime from Washington lobbyists or special interest PACs.
But see, the DNC has raised only about a half as much money as the Republican National Committee has. So we asked Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson how this decision might affect what happens in November.
Business, labor, and other interests run political action committees to raise money for candidates. But PAC money doesn't make up that big a chunk of the DNC's funds, only a couple million dollars out of more than $82 million raised so far this campaign season. Money from lobbyists is even less. Michael Malbin, who directs the Campaign Finance Institute, says Senator Obama's decision is clever.
I think he's making a calculation that the value of the issue is worth more than the value of the money.
But, says Republican National Committee spokesman Danny Diaz, a lot of special interests are still free to contribute despite the DNC ban.
Former lobbyists, unregistered lobbyists, firm partners of lobbyists, state lobbyists. This is simply a PR stunt.
Asked whether the RNC plans to take a similar step and ban lobbyist and PAC contributions, Diaz said this.
We don't plan on changing our process at this point.
But individual politicians might, particularly if they're able to duplicate Barack Obama's incredible fundraising success, mostly small donations, without which none of this would be happening. Douglas Weber is with the Center for Responsive Politics.
If it does work, if Obama's model of getting a lot of small individual donations can be duplicated, that does change the fundraising landscape quite a lot.
Weber says you'll know the landscape has changed if congressional candidates are able to ban lobbyists and PAC contributions and still get elected. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Oh, it was ugly today, just ugly in the markets. We'll have the details and the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. Let me get back to those jobs numbers that sort of got lost in the oil story today. Much as unemployment's a lagging indicator, it tells you what already happened in the economy. Employment itself tends to lag as well. It's only when demand for products and services heats back up after a slowdown that companies start hiring again. Sounds like it makes sense, but commentator and economist Mark Toma says that might not hold true this time around.
Most people think of a recession as a time when layoffs increase, but changes in the number of people firms hire, not changes in the number of people losing jobs, have the most effect on employment over the business cycle. In the two most recent recessions, the downside of the cycle was the same as it ever was. Employment tracked output with a lag. But on the upside, the hiring rate didn't pick up as it has in the past. It took much longer for firms to begin hiring again. That's not good news for job seekers. Why has the relationship between output and employment changed? One possibility is globalization. Under this story, as the economy begins to recover and firms need more workers, jobs are outsourced to foreign countries where labor is cheaper. Another possibility, and a story that seems to fit much better with the evidence, is that it's technology. As the economy begins to turn around, firms invest in machinery and technology. This allows the company to increase output without hiring as many new workers. If it is technology, skilled labor, and people in jobs that cannot be easily digitized or replaced by machinery should do well. But the recovery will offer less certainty for jobs that are subject to these technological forces. The Fed has responded aggressively and creatively, and that should help. But fiscal policymakers should have recognized that employment tends to recover sluggishly in a recession. They should have implemented policies that create jobs, but they didn't. So the failure of regulators to prevent the problems in the first place will be compounded by the failure of fiscal policy to truly help the unemployed.
Mark Toma is a professor of economics at the University of Oregon. He blogs at The Economist's View. What's your view? You can tell us. Go to marketplace.org and then click on that link that says contact. Even with the jobless rate at 5.5%, the unemployment situation in this country is pretty good by most measures. But what about the underemployed, people who have sporadic or maybe regular part-time work, but they aren't making enough to cover the costs of food and permanent housing? Marketplace's Jennifer Collins visited one strip of pavement here in Los Angeles that some of them call home.
Gary Crow shares his home with his adult son and two dogs. And there's something else he wants you to know. Everything he owns hums along very well, thank you.
Microwave, stove oven, everything works.
And everything has its place, even if the fridge is practically on top of the shower. Gary lives in a 10-foot camper hitched to the back of a pickup truck. 3 years ago, he lived in a house, but when his expenses climbed above $2,000 a month, Gary didn't make enough as a freelance mechanic to cover the bills.
The rent just got way too high and didn't have a choice.
Gary pays about $500 a month to keep his gas tank full and his generator running. He rarely notices the traffic that rattles his home as it flies by on Riverside Drive. That's the thoroughfare just north of downtown Los Angeles where Gary parks. These days, Riverside is starting to get very crowded.
Well, if you look down the street, you see all these motorhomes? About a year ago, they wasn't all there, but it just seemed like it's getting worse.
Social workers from Oregon to Georgia say they're seeing clusters of dilapidated vans and motorhomes cropping up along byways throughout the country. As food and rent become more expensive, they say some people are trying to save money by living in their vehicles. Many have day jobs, but at night, their home is wherever they roll. Michael Stoops is the acting director for the National Coalition for the Homeless.
I promise you, we will see a tremendous increase over the next couple years in people living in their vehicles.
He says homeless organizations need to designate safe overnight parking. Very few places have programs like that. So in cities like LA, nearby homeowners complain about the dinged up campers. Police order the homeless to move along, but there are rarely enough places to park, and even the homeless worry about the people who share their streets.
Well, he won't. No, I don't got to ask him. He's already told.
That's Steve. He won't give his last name because he sells heroin for a living. A sign on his RV says "Welcome" in big letters. Just outside, there's a woman trying to hawk her engagement ring. Steve says his customers have been pretty desperate lately.
Even people who do drugs have no money. The working economy, if they don't have no money, then the people that bring me their money can't get no money.
Steve says his income is only a sliver of what it was in more prosperous times. But he sticks to the same streets. He says his customers need to know where to find him. Just down Riverside, there's Sam Tejada. Sam's got a family that depends on him back home in El Salvador. His 18-year-old daughter is in college there. He sends remittances whenever he can.
If he not send it for my family, you know, is no good.
Sam works in construction, but jobs have been spotty these days. So to save money, he moved into a motorhome. And that's how Sam ended up sharing the streets with Gary, Steve, and dozens of others.
Sometimes the people think when somebody live like me, maybe this guy make drug or drinking, or maybe he doesn't work, something like that. Maybe it's illegal.
Sam's lived here for 14 years. He has papers to prove he's legal, but he's thinking of giving it all up.
The economy situation is not good. Maybe 5 months, if the situation is going to be like that, I come back to my country.
Maybe it's the wheels under their feet, but almost everyone on Riverside talks about moving on. It's only a matter of when. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street. We go to Dallas to do that, where David Johnson, I think, is probably counting his lucky stars it wasn't worse. How you feeling there, big guy?
Wait a minute. I think they took my lucky stars away from me today,
right. You don't get any lucky stars.
I'm not sure. Let me look. Yep, they're gone, too. They picked us clean today, Kai. Just everything went down. There are 30 stocks in the industrials average. All of them were down today. The transportation stocks were down. The utility stocks were down. Motherhood was down. Apple pie was down. The flag was down.
You got blindsided, huh?
Yeah, it really was. I mean, this is the thing. I really thought we had this thing figured out. This is a big trading range back and forth, and we're worried about the credit crisis. No, we're worried about oil. No, we're worried about jobs. And today we just sort of got hit by everything. I mean, 5.5% unemployment rate. You can really explain that away with the job losses that were less than expected and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But that kind of set the stage. The dollar got weaker. Then you get a big short squeeze like we had yesterday, which caused oil to go up.
So this was all oil today, you think, right?
I think, you know, when it's up $10.75 in one day to $138.54, and Morgan Stanley says it's going to 150 by the 4th of July, I mean, you got to think a lot of it's oil.
All right. Well, here's what I want to know then, though. If this is so bad, and I don't argue that it's, you know, not bad, how come the Dow wasn't down 600 points today?
We ran out of time.
Darn those short trading days.
They would give me another hour or so. No, they were still selling off on the close. Hey, it was kind of slow going early on, but it was just sort of a rotational kill. They killed all the logical stuff. Then they came back through and killed, you know, the stuff that you wouldn't have thought would be sensitive to oil prices. I mean, you could understand, you know, some big trucking firm going down something like that, but. You know, Apple, for example, had been resistant to this for a long time. Google, you know, we laughingly said, you know, they don't consume oil. There's no subprime loans that are outstanding at Google. Right. You know, you can go put your money in technology. The NASDAQ had held up really well. And now the NASDAQ gets bumped. Dow's biggest drop since February of 2007.
All right,
it
so,
was a thumping.
It was indeed, to paraphrase President Bush. But let me ask you this then. What if the Morgan Stanley guy is right? And what if, heaven forfend, the Goldman Sachs guys are right and it's $200 by the end of the year? What happens then?
Well, I mean, if it's $200 by the end of the year, then that's a whole nother ballgame. I really think it may well be that gasoline hitting $4 a gallon in many parts of the country, and it may have been, with hindsight, maybe even breaking $3, was sort of a tipping point. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you get more people conserving, and, you know, I really got to think, that a lot of people are going to stay home and a lot of things are going to get shut down if we go that high.
All right, well, we shall see. I'm going to keep driving the minivan, though. Because, you know, it's that
yeah,
stylish.
Yeah, not very far.
David Johnson down in Dallas. Thank you, David.
Have a good weekend, Kai.
You too. Coming up, betting on the future of horse races.
You know, what drives us is gambling. And gambling is a tough business because we have a lot of competition.
But first, let's do the numbers. Probably don't need to tell you rising oil prices and job numbers hammered Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials dropped 3.1%, 394 points. Closed at 12,209, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ crumbled 2.9%, 75 points to close at 2,474. The S&P 500 slid 3.9%, 40 points, ended the day and the week at 1,360. For the week that was, the Dow lost nearly 400 points, 3 4/10%. The NASDAQ dropped 1 9/10%. The S&P 500 shed more than 2.5%. The bad news about oil seeped everywhere. Walmart gave back 2 1/3%. General Electric lost 3 1/3%. General Motors geared down 4 8/10%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat. Available now. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. The ACLU membership conference continues in Washington. Apple kicks off its worldwide development conference in San Francisco. New iProduct? We'll have to wait and see. And musician inventor Les Paul turns 93. He's still performing. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The president's going to be up bright and early Monday morning. He's off for what will probably be his last major trip to Europe. Expectations are that he'll get a reasonably warm reception at a big U.S.-European summit meeting next week, and that one of the most bitter trade disputes between the two sides might actually wind up getting settled. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The Europeans are terribly finicky about food. They've banned a string of American farm products, like hormone-treated beef and genetically modified corn. They've banned American chickens, expressing horror at the way they're processed. Andrew Bounds is with the Financial Times.
You know, I've heard hair-raising descriptions from officials in the Commission of just how these birds are sort of allowed to wallow in their entrails until they are basically dunked in a bath of chlorine.
But there has been recent talk of the ban on chlorine-washed chicken being lifted next week. That looks a little premature. Nevertheless, Sean Rickard, an agricultural economist, says European governments are beginning to change their minds about other American farm exports.
They're going to, I think, take a much more relaxed attitude towards genetically modified crops in the future, and they're going to be much happier to import genetically modified animal feed.
He says that soaring feed prices are hurting European livestock farmers, and they are clamouring for the cheaper genetically modified varieties.
And I think this time next year we'll see a very different attitude from European governments towards modern farming techniques, and in particular genetically modified technology.
When President Bush dines with European leaders in Slovenia next week, chlorine-washed chicken and hormone-treated beef probably won't be on the menu. But if the price of food continues to rise, the Europeans may soon find cheap American farm produce irresistible. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
He's 3 years old, weighs about 1,200 pounds, can run a mile in something less than 2 minutes. And if all goes as expected, by this time tomorrow, Big Brown will be the first horse to have won the Triple Crown in 30 years. Triple Crown's one of the most prestigious titles in sports, and what used to be called the sport of kings. But away from the big crowds and the big money of marquee events like tomorrow's Belmont Stakes, horse racing is a more difficult business.
My name is Chris. I'm the managing partner of Joyride Racing.
Early in the morning at the Santa Anita Racetrack outside Los Angeles, Chris Atkinson's walking us through the barns. Joyride Racing, the ownership group that he runs, has a couple of horses here, including one that almost made it to the Kentucky Derby last year.
This is Noble Court, and he's kind of our lead horse of the stable.
Does he know he's the lead horse?
Yeah, he knows. You can kind of tell by his attitude. You see where he's a little bit, you know, feisty and cocky, and
Even though Noble didn't quite make it to the big show, he got hurt right before the Derby. Atkinson says getting close was pretty good.
That's what we're all hoping for. I mean, one day you run across a horse that's good enough to get there.
And dreams are great, but thoroughbred racing's not quite what it used to be. Trackside attendance is way down. In New York, home state of tomorrow's Belmont, it's off almost 20% since the beginning of the decade. What's called the handle, that's a fancy word for the amount of money bet, has dropped by $1 billion nationwide since 2003. For most of us, the idea of a day at the track sounds something like this. But Atkinson and others think the business side of the sport needs a new soundtrack.
I literally study what NASCAR has done and go down that road. You know, the way that they integrate themselves into the everyday life of the general consumer and the sports fan and the racing fan is a real lesson for us to learn in this business. And I think we've got to take a step back and really look at how we can repackage the sport and remarket it.
If this makes you think of jockeys wearing corporate logos instead of silks and horses with brand names stenciled on their sides, take it easy. That's not going to happen. But Atkinson's trainer, John Sadler, said what might work is something more organizational, a national horse racing league, one that could drive marketing and sales and get people back in the stands.
We don't have a central ruling body. Each state is their own jurisdiction, each racetrack, you know, they may be competing with the other tracks. So we need a central racing body, in my opinion.
Do we have a league? Are we the NFL? No, we're not the NFL.
Alex Waldrop runs racing's main trade group, the National Thoroughbred Racing Association.
The primary difference between us and the NFL and most other league sports is that we're highly regulated at the state level.
Why? Because almost $15 billion was bet, and bet legally, on horse racing last year. Gambling's really what drives the sport. It supplies an enormous pool of money. And in the absence of big corporate sponsorship, betting funds the purses that let owners afford to race their horses. It's also the thing that's hurting thoroughbred racing the most. For one, gambling sort of makes the track a turnoff for a day out with the family. But also, the rise of off-track betting means people don't have to show up to bet. They can do it almost wherever they want. Although, for the life of me, I can't figure out how anybody makes money betting on horses.
So if I want to get really fancy, can I bet, like, Guts to finish first and Meerkat to finish second?
Sure.
All right, now how do I do that?
Okay, you want to spend $5, so you do a $2 box, 2 and 6. Now, that would be $4 because it's $2 each way.
Okay.
But what you can do also, you can say, let me have a $3 straight exact at 2-6 and a $2 exact at 6-2. How's that sound?
Those bits where you heard me nodding and agreeing with the guy? I was making that up. I had no idea what he was talking about. But people who do know how to bet are going to show up at racetracks all over the country tomorrow to watch a simulcast of the Belmont Stakes and maybe plunk down a couple of bucks on Big Brown to win. After the race, though, it's going to be right back to the grind of getting bodies in the seats. At Hollywood Park here in Los Angeles, the sport of kings has been reduced to this, offering dollar hot dogs and beer on Friday nights.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today before we let you go. Imagine you're a big retailer, say Sears or Macy's, and there's a huge power outage in, I don't know, Chicago. Bad, but not terrible, right? Because you've got thousands of other stores all around the country. Now, though, consider a glitch that shuts down every single store you have, and you've got some idea of what happened today to Amazon.com. The Internet's biggest retailer was offline for more than 2 hours today. It's been spotty since then. Ad Age ran some numbers and figures based on quarterly revenue. It says every hour offline costs Amazon almost $2 million. We called Amazon to get a comment for ourselves. They said, basically, nothing to see here. Move right along. Wouldn't tell me what happened to take the site offline. And on that note, that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Friday. Today, the Dow heaved off 394 points, 3.1%. The NASDAQ whacked away 75 points, 2.9%. The S&P 500 sank 40 points. That is 3.9% there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is JJ Ure. Coming up on Monday, American winemakers toast to the strength of the euro.
Our exports have an advantage going overseas, and imports are at a disadvantage coming in. So all signs are rosy, or rosé, as we say.
Rosé. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.